Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
The quarantine continues. How you holding up? It's been weird in the neighborhood. You can tell everybody's starting to get cabin fever. A lot of people are outside, you know, with the kiddos, and you know, the kids are on scooters and bikes and doing chalk art on the driveway. People are coming up with ideas in the neighborhood to spread good cheer. They're putting teddy bears in windows and various projects, trying to find ways to support the local businesses. I saw there was a Facebook page post for the neighborhood where they were suggesting having several homes on a street or even in the whole neighborhood area ordering from a specific restaurant, and they do a mass delivery, and then we get to tip the drivers and support the local restaurant. You know, people are innovative. I'm interested to see how the COVID-19 crisis changes us and how creative we get in coming together. I saw an article. No. I was listening to NPR News, and they were talking about how the Israelis and the Palestinians are cooperating in some ways, a few ways, to try to defeat COVID-19 or at least stop the spread. I mean, the Israelis and the Palestinians are, in a few instances, putting aside their long history of differences, and they are cooperating. Is that right? And I wonder, does that begin to change some relationships in that arena? I don't know. I'll have to go look the article up. I hope I'm not spreading misinformation, but it was something I'd heard on the radio on the newscast yesterday. And I thought, you know, if you take a couple of divided tribes and you give them a common enemy, they then, in many cases, are forced to cooperate. Does that help to bring down the barriers between them? And maybe help to create human bonds that surpass their differences. The optimist in me certainly hopes so. We need some optimism in these times. And I'm going to do my best to try to be a part of the solution. Hell, I don't know what else to do except provide content for you. This is bonus material. It's totally free to patrons. My listeners had asked, as a distraction, as a vacation for the imagination while so many people are holed up, if I would read various selections that they provided. This is just random stuff for me to read. They know I'm a storyteller. And I'm honored to be able to do that. We had great success with the first incarnation of this. We did some Douglas Adams, had some Dr. Seuss, Harlan Ellison's beautiful story, about an hour long, called Jeffy is Five. Really enjoyed that one. And I think the listeners did as well. I'm getting a lot of great feedback. And so I have another smattering of smattering is a good word. This is just a random selection of readable stuff. Rob sent me a message and asked if I would, he knows I like stroop waffles. He said, would you read the recipe for stroop waffles, but read it in Dutch? I got to apologize on the front end of this. First of all, I'm not going to read the whole recipe in Dutch, but Dutch, you know, I had the honor of going to Amsterdam. It's like a year and a half ago. And I spoke there, and Natalie and I did a tour of Europe, and it was just such an honor to be there. But I was struck by the fact that the United States is one of the few first world nations that only really speaks one language. We are ignorant of other languages, whereas so many other countries, you are taught from your earliest ages. You know, you are bilingual, trilingual, and I think they commonly speak up to three languages. In the Netherlands, They can drift from one to the other. It's impressive. It's amazing. And Dutch is, as I understand it, one of the most difficult languages to learn and master in the world. And after hearing it, I understand why. Stroopwafels. If you don't know what a stroopwafel is, it's essentially straight-up sugar. Here's a photograph. So there's caramel in the middle and these sort of cakey things, and you place them over your coffee. I discovered these on a flight years ago, rather, on the way to a convention. They served them. The flight attendant said, "Would you like a stroopwafel?" And I'm like, "What the hell's that?" And you put this over your coffee. You lay it over the cup, and the warm coffee then warms up the stroopwafel, and it sort of makes the caramel all soft and gooey. And you put that in your mouth, and it is heaven, right? You'll need a dentist afterwards. But it is heaven. The recipe for stroopwafels in Dutch, just a few lines. 1/2 kopje warme melk. This is a redneck trying to do Dutch, and I think you're supposed to do a throaty thing. I don't mean to insult the Dutch. I'm so sorry, okay? But from my vantage in Oklahoma, properly spoken Dutch sounds like a Tasmanian devil is trying to crawl out of your throat. 1/2 kopje warme melk. Like they're always doing that thing, that throaty thing. And there's a real nuance to it. 1 packet active talking gist. Like how do you do that? It's really impressive. 4 kopjes. Oh my God, 1/2 cup warm milk, 1 package active dry yeast, 4 cups all-purpose flour, plus more for dusting, 3/4 cup granulated sugar, 1/2 teaspoon ground cinnamon, 1/4 teaspoon fine salt, 2 sticks of unsalted butter cut into 1/2 inch pieces. Oh, you had me at butter. You had me at butter. 2 large eggs, lightly beaten. Wait, I just lost the recipe. Okay, here we go. For the waffles, place the warm milk in a small bowl and whisk the yeast into the milk. Allow the mixture to sit until bubbly, about 5 minutes. Okay, so the warm milk and the yeast are having a conversation. These ingredients are communing. There's an intercourse of ingredients happening here. Put the flour, granulated sugar, cinnamon, and salt in a food processor and pulse until the ingredients are combined. Add the butter and pulse until it resembles coarse meal. Add the eggs and the yeast mixture and pulse to combine. Turn the dough into a lightly floured surface and knead just until the dough comes together in a nice ball 5 to 7 times. Set aside to rest for 45 minutes. Oh, yeah, don't you love it when the ingredients have time to sort of settle together, right? Natalie likes to say, the ingredients have to talk about it. Hey, you got to put them in a room and let the ingredients talk about it for just a little bit. This is where the goodness comes from. Preheat a waffle cone iron on the medium-high setting from the dough into 16 equal balls, about 2.5 ounces each. Flatten one ball until it forms a disc and place in the waffle cone iron. Shut the iron lid, but don't clamp closed. Bake until crisp and golden, occasionally pressing down on the iron lid 1 to 2 minutes. While the waffle's still warm, cut out a circle using a 4.5-inch round cutter, then split the waffle horizontally using a knife. That sounds difficult. These suckers are thin anyway, and you're supposed to cut them horizontally because those babies are thin. For the filling, combine the molasses, brown sugar, corn syrup, butter, and cinnamon in a small saucepan over medium heat and bring to a boil. Bring to the soft ball stage, 235 to 240 degrees Fahrenheit on a candy thermometer, stirring constantly 8 to 10 minutes. Pour into a heat-resistant glass measuring cup and allow the mixture to cool until it thickens but is still spreadable about 10 minutes. If the filling gets too thick, rewarm in the microwave. Spread 2 tablespoons of filling on the cut side of a waffle and top with the other half. Allow the cookies to cool completely. Do you see what I mean? This is why Stroop waffles are one of the greatest things in the universe. Stroop waffles. I have a sweet tooth anyway. I struggle. I've had to do sugar substitutes because, you know, I was eating so much sugar, I think it was starting to affect me. Plus, I was starting to look like the Pillsbury Doughboy. But I mean, does anyone else struggle with that? You've got a, you've got a sweet tooth, Someone had suggested H.P. Lovecraft. Lorian said, read something from Lovecraft. So in a gear shift, let me read from H.P. Lovecraft. This one's called The Outsider. This is a slightly longer piece. And it goes like this. It starts with a quote from Keats. That night the Baron dreamt of many a woe, and all his warrior guests, with shade and form of witch and demon and large coffin worm, were long be nightmared. Unhappy is he to whom the memories of childhood bring only fear and sadness. Wretched is he who looks back upon lone hours in vast and dismal chambers with brown hangings and maddening rows of antique books, or upon awed watches and twilight groves of grotesque, gigantic, and vine-encumbered trees that suddenly wave twisted branches far aloft. Such a lot the gods gave to me, the dazed, the disappointed, the barren, the broken. And yet I am strangely content and cling desperately to those sere moments when my mind momentarily threatens to reach beyond to the other. I know not where I was born, save that the castle was infinitely old and infinitely horrible, full of dark passages and having high ceilings where the eye could find only cobwebs and shadows. The stones in the crumbling corridors seemed always hideously damp, and there was an accursed smell everywhere, as of the piled-up corpses of dead generations. It was never light, so that I used sometimes to light candles and gaze steadily at them for relief, nor was there any sun outdoors, since the terrible trees grew high above the topmost accessible tower. There is one black tower which reached above the trees into the unknown outer sky, but that was partly ruined and could not be ascended save by a well-nigh impossible climb up the sheer wall, stone by stone. I must have lived years in this place, but I cannot measure the time. Beings must have cared for my needs, and I cannot recall any person save myself, or anything alive but the noiseless rats and bats and spiders. I think that whoever nursed me must have been shockingly aged, since my first conception of a living person was that of something mockingly like myself, yet distorted, shriveled, and decaying like the castle. To me, there was nothing grotesque in the bones and skeletons that strode some of the stone crypts deep down among the foundations. I fantastically associated these things with everyday events, and thought them more natural than the colored pictures of living beings which I found in many of the moldy books. From such books I learned all that I know. No teacher urged or guided me, and I do not recall hearing any human voice in all those years, not even my own. For although I had read of speech, I'd never thought to try to speak aloud. My aspect was a matter equally unthought of, for there were no mirrors in the castle, and I merely regarded myself by instinct as akin to the youthful figures I saw drawn and painted in the books. I felt conscious of youth, because I remembered so little. Outside, across the putrid moat and under the dark mute trees, I would often lie and dream for hours about what I read in the books, and I would longingly picture myself amidst gay crowds in the sunny world beyond the endless forest. Once I tried to escape from the forest, but as I went farther from the castle, the shade grew denser and the air more filled with brooding fear, so that I ran frantically back, lest I lose my way in a labyrinth of nighted silence. So through endless twilights I dreamed and waited, though I knew not what I waited for. Then in the shadowy solitude my longing for light grew so frantic that I could rest no more, and I lifted entreating hands to the single black ruined tower that reached above the forest into the unknown outer sky, and at last I resolved to scale that tower, fall though I might, since it were better to glimpse the sky and perish than to live without ever beholding day. In the dank twilight, I climbed the worn and aged stone stairs till I reached the level where they ceased, and therefore clung perilously to small footholds leading upward. Ghastly and terrible was that dead, stairless cylinder of rock, black, ruined, and deserted, and sinister with startled bats whose wings made no noise. But more ghastly and terrible still was the slowness of my progress, for climb as I might, the darkness overhead grew no thinner, and a new chill as of haunted and venerable mold assailed me. I shivered as I wondered why I did not reach the light, and would have looked down had I dared. I fancied that night had come suddenly upon me, and vainly groped with one free hand for a window embrasure, that I might peer out and above and try to judge the height I'd attained. All at once, after an infinity of awesome sightless crawling up that concave and desperate precipice, I felt my head touch a solid thing, and I knew I must have gained the roof, or at least some kind of floor. In the darkness I raised my free hand and tested the barrier, finding it stone and immovable. Then came a deadly circuit of the tower, clinging to whatever holes the slimy wall could give, till finally my testing hand found the barrier yielding, and I turned upward again, pushing the slab or door with my head as I used both hands in my fearful ascent. There was no light revealed above, and as my hands went higher, I knew that my climb was for the nonce ended. Since the slab was the trap door of an aperture leading to a level stone surface of greater circumference than the lower tower, no doubt the floor of some lofty and capacious observation chamber, I crawled through carefully and tried to prevent the heavy slab from falling back into place, but failed in the latter attempt. As I lay exhausted on the stone floor, I heard the eerie echoes of its fall, but hoped when necessary to pry it open again. Believing I was now at a prodigious height, far above the accursed branches of the wood, I dragged myself up from the floor and fumbled about for windows, that I might look for the first time upon the sky, and the moon and stars of which I had read. But on every hand I was disappointed, since all that I found were vast shelves of marble, bearing odious oblong boxes of disturbing size. More and more I reflected and wondered what hoary secrets might abide in this high apartment, so many eons cut off from the castle below. Then unexpectedly my hands came upon a doorway, where hung a portal of stone, rough with strange chiseling. Trying it, I found it locked. But with a supreme burst of strength I overcame all obstacles and dragged it open inward. As I did, so there came to me the purest ecstasy I have ever known, for shining tranquilly through an ornate grating of iron, and down a short stone passageway of steps that ascended from the newly found doorway, was the radiant full moon, which I had never before seen, save in dreams and in vague visions I dared not call memories. Fancying now that I had attained the very pinnacle of the castle, I commenced to rush up the few steps beyond the door, but the sudden veiling of the moon by a cloud caused me to stumble, and I felt my way more slowly in the dark. It was still very dark when I reached the grating, which I tried carefully and found unlocked, but which I did not open for fear of falling from the amazing height to which I'd climbed. Then the moon came out. Most demonical of all shocks is that of the abysmally unexpected and grotesquely unbelievable. Nothing I'd before undergone could compare in terror with what I now saw, with the bizarre marvels that sight implied. The sight itself was as simple as it was stupefying, for it was merely this. Instead of a dizzying prospect of treetops seen from a lofty eminence, there stretched around me on a level through the grating nothing less than the solid ground, decked and diversified by marble slabs and columns, and overshadowed by an ancient stone church, whose ruined spire gleamed spectrally in the moonlight. Half unconscious, I opened the grating and staggered out upon the white gravel path that stretched away in two directions. My mind, stunned and chaotic as it was, still held the frantic craving for light, and not even the fantastic wonder which had happened could stay my course. I neither knew nor cared whether my experience was insanity, dreaming, or magic, but was determined to gaze on brilliance and gaiety at any cost. I knew not who I was, or what my surroundings might be. Though as I continued to stumble along, I became conscious of a kind of fearsome, latent memory that made my progress not wholly fortuitous. I passed under an arch out of that region of slabs and columns and wandered through the open country, sometimes following the visible road, but sometimes leaving it curiously to tread across meadows where only occasional ruins bespoke the ancient presence of a forgotten land. Once I swam across the swift river where crumbling, mossy masonry told of a bridge long vanished. Over 2 hours must have passed before I reached what seemed to be my goal, a venerable, ivied castle in a thickly wooded park, maddeningly familiar, yet full of perplexing strangeness to me. I saw that the moat was filled in, and that some of the well-known towers were demolished, whilst new wings existed to confuse the beholder. But what I observed with chief interest and delight were the open windows, gorgeously ablaze with light and sending forth sound of the gayest revelry. Advancing to one of these, I looked in and saw an oddly dressed company, indeed, making merry and speaking brightly to one another. I had never seemingly heard human speech before and could guess only vaguely what was said. Some of the faces seemed to hold expressions that brought up incredibly remote recollections. Others were utterly alien. I now stepped through the low window into the brilliantly lighted room, stepping as I did so from my single bright moment of hope to my blackest convulsion of despair and realization. The nightmare was quick to come, for as I entered, there occurred immediately one of the most terrifying demonstrations I had ever conceived. Scarcely had I crossed the sill when there descended upon the whole company a sudden and unheralded fear of hideous intensity, distorting every face and evoking the most horrible screams from nearly every throat. Flight was universal, and in the clamor and panic, several fell in a swoon and were dragged away by their madly fleeing companions. Many covered their eyes with their hands and plunged blindly and awkwardly in their race to escape, overturning furniture and stumbling against the walls before they managed to reach one of the many doors. The cries were shocking. And as I stood in the brilliant apartment alone and dazed, listening to their vanishing echoes, I trembled at the thought of what might be lurking near me unseen. At a casual inspection, the room seemed deserted, but when I moved toward one of the alcoves, I thought I detected a presence there. A hint of motion beyond the golden arched doorway leading to another and somewhat similar room. As I approached the arch, I began to perceive the presence more clearly, and then, with the first and last sound I ever uttered, a ghastly ululation that revolted me almost as poignantly as its noxious cause, I beheld in full frightful vividness the inconceivable, indescribable, and unmentionable monstrosity which had by its simple appearance changed a merry company to a herd of delirious fugitives. I could not even hint what it was like, for it was a compound of all that was unclean, uncanny, unwelcome, abnormal, and detestable. It was the ghoulish shade of decay, antiquity, and desolation, the putrid, dripping eidolon of unwholesome revelation, the awful bearing of that which the merciful earth should always hide. God knows it was not of this world, or no longer of this world. Yet to my horror I saw in its eaten away and bone-revealing outlines a leering, abhorrent travesty on the human shape, and in its moldy, disintegrating apparel, an unspeakable quality that chilled me even more. I was almost paralyzed, but not too much so to make a feeble effort toward flight. My backward stumble, which failed to break the spell in which the nameless, voiceless monster held me. My eyes, bewitched by the glassy orbs, which stared loathsomely into them, refused to close, though they were mercifully blurred, and shewed the terrible object but indistinctly after the first shock. I tried to raise my hand to shut out the sight, yet so stunned were my nerves that my arm could not fully obey my will. The attempt, however, was enough to disturb my balance, so that I had to stagger forward several steps to avoid falling. As I did so, I became suddenly and agonizingly aware of the nearness of the carrion thing, whose hideous, hollow breathing I half fancied I could hear. Nearly mad, I found myself yet able to throw out a hand to ward off the fetid apparition which pressed so close, when in one cataclysmic second of cosmic nightmarishness and hellish accident, my fingers touched the rotting, outstretched paw of the monster beneath the golden arch. I did not shriek, but all the fiendish ghouls that ride the night wind shrieked for me, as in that same second there crashed down upon my mind a single and fleeting avalanche of soul-annihilating memory. I knew in that second all that had been. I remembered beyond the frightful castle and the trees, and recognized the altered edifice in which I now stood. I recognized, most terrible of all, the unholy abomination that stood leering before me as I withdrew my sullied fingers from its own. But in the cosmos there is balm as well as bitterness, and that balm is Nepenthe. In the supreme horror of that second I forgot what had horrified me, and the burst of black memory vanished in a chaos of echoing images. In a dream I fled from that haunted and accursed pile and ran swiftly and silently in the moonlight. When I returned to the churchyard place of marble and went down the steps, I found the stone trap door immovable. But I was not sorry, for I had hated the antique castle and the trees. Now I ride with the mocking and friendly ghouls on the night wind, and play by day amongst the catacombs of Nefrin-Ka in the sealed and unknown valley of the Hadoth by the Nile. I know that light is not for me, save of that moon over the rock tombs of Neb, nor any gaiety save the untamed feast of Nitocris beneath the great pyramid. Yet in my new wildness and freedom, I almost welcome the bitterness of alienage. For although Nepenthe has calmed me, I know always that I am an outsider, a stranger in this century and among those who are still men. This I have known ever since I stretched out my fingers to the abomination within that great gilded frame, stretched out my fingers and touched a cold and unyielding surface of polished glass. No, that's heavy stuff. Of course, it's going to be heavy stuff, of course. It's Lovecraft. It's interesting to read that out loud. It does conjure a lot of visions. I enjoy that kind of storytelling, you know, where it takes you to a dark place and then you realize it's a moment of self-reflection, right? The monster within. Who was it? It was John, forgive me, I don't mean to diminish Lovecraft by invoking the filmmaker John Carpenter, but I remember once in a documentary he was talking about horrors and how there are two types of horrors out there. There is the horror out there, right? The other is coming to get us. We see a lot of that kind of thing. You know, they're coming to kill us or enslave us or infect us, the other outside. And the second is the horror within, right? I've seen the monster and he is us. And in many ways, I think those are the more effective types of horrors, the evil within kind of thing. Let's seriously shift gears into a children's story. Now, this is a random thing. Like, I didn't lay these out in a specific way, so forgive sort of the, it's an abrupt turn. All right, so we're going to lighten the mood, and we're going to read from something which was suggested by Frida. It is a book, or a short story, rather, called Corduroy. And it goes like this. Corduroy is a bear who once lived in the toy department of a big store. Day after day, he waited with all the other animals and dolls for someone to come along and take him. The store was always filled with shoppers buying all sorts of things, but no one ever seemed to want a small bear in green overalls. Then one morning, a little girl stopped and looked straight into Corduroy's bright eyes. "Oh, Mommy," she said, "look, there's the very bear I've always wanted." "Not today, dear," her mother sighed. "I've spent too much already. Besides, he doesn't look new. He's lost the button to one of his shoulder straps." Corduroy watched them sadly as they walked away. "I didn't know I'd lost a button," he said to himself. "Tonight I'll go and see if I can find it." Late that evening, when all the shoppers had gone and the doors were shut and locked, Corduroy climbed carefully down from his shelf and began searching everywhere on the floor for his lost button. Suddenly he felt the floor moving under him. Quite by accident, he had stepped onto an escalator, and up he went. Could this be a mountain? He wondered. I think I've always wanted to climb a mountain. He stepped off the escalator as it reached the next floor, and there before his eyes was a most amazing sight. Tables and chairs and lamps and sofas and rows of beds. "This must be a palace," Corduroy gasped. "I guess I've always wanted to live in a palace." He wandered around admiring the furniture. "This must be a bed," he said. "I've always wanted to sleep in a bed." And he crawled up onto a large, thick mattress. All at once, he saw something small and round. "Why, here's my button," he cried, and he tried to pick it up. But like all the other buttons on the mattress, it was tied down tight. He yanked and pulled with both paws until pop! Off came the button, and off the mattress, Corduroy toppled, bang, into a tall floor lamp. Over it fell with a crash. Corduroy didn't know it, but there was someone else awake in the store. The night watchman was going his rounds on the floor above. When he heard the crash, he came dashing down the escalator. "Now who in the world did that?" he exclaimed. "There must be somebody hiding around here." He flashed his light under and over sofas and beds until he came to the biggest bed of all. And there he saw two fuzzy brown ears sticking up from under the cover. "Hello," he said. "How did you get upstairs?" The watchman tucked Corduroy under his arm and carried him down the escalator and set him on the shelf in the toy department with the other animals and dolls. Corduroy was just waking up when the first customers came into the store in the morning. And there, looking at him with a wide, warm smile, was the same little girl he'd seen only the day before. "I'm Lisa," she said, "and you're going to be my very own bear. Last night I counted what I've saved in my piggy bank, and my mother said I could bring you home." "Shall I put him in a box for you?" the sales lady asked. "No, thank you," Lisa answered. And she carried Corduroy home in her arms. She ran all the way up 4 flights of stairs into her family's apartment and straight to her own room. Corduroy blinked. There was a chair and a chest of drawers, and alongside a girl-sized bed stood a little bed just the right size for him. The room was small, nothing like that enormous palace in the department store. "This must be home," he said. "I know I've always wanted a home." Lisa sat down with Corduroy on her lap and began to sew a button on his overalls. "I like you the way you are," she said, "but you'll be more comfortable with your shoulder strap fastened." "You must be a friend," said Corduroy. "I've always wanted a friend." "Me too," said Lisa, and gave him a big hug. Oh, I needed that story to have a happy ending, didn't you? I needed Corduroy to be in a good place at the end of that one. No Lovecraft, please, in the Corduroy story. Anything to do with puffy, sweet, soft, stuffed animals needs to have a happy ending. Animals in general, I feel that. I'm guilty of this when it comes to animals. Did you know? There's a website called Does the Dog Die? Now, let me explain this to you real fast. Now, you're probably a step ahead of me. But you know those films where everybody dies, action movies like John Wick. I rented John Wick 3 the other day, and it's like Count the Dead. It's that genre of film where everybody gets killed, but nobody gets hurt, right? You're emotionally divorced from what's happening. You realize this is a roller coaster. This is an amusement park. This is an exercise. This is absolute fiction. And so you're not emotionally invested. The things that they do in that film, if you saw it done to your fellow human being, you would be aghast. You'd be emotionally hamstrung for the rest of your life. But in the movies, you know, if the dog dies, and a dog got shot, I think, in the second film, it was the first film, John Wick. If the dog dies, it is almost a deal breaker for me. I cannot take it. And there's a website for people like us where you can go to Does the Dog Die, the website, and you can find out in it before you buy your tickets in advance if the dog is going to get offed. And if it happens, they warn you, look out, buyer beware, don't go to this film because the dog dies. I would almost not buy it. I think I might not buy a ticket if I knew that somebody was going to off a dog. Distraction there. I got derailed from the train. Still to come, I have some political nonfiction about Christian nationalism from journalist and author Catherine Stewart. And we'll do some Carl Sagan and The Pale Blue Dot, one of my favorite works from Sagan. We'll do that on the other side of this. Hang on. I'm so glad you're here, so glad you're listening as we read some various selections, just because we've got the time and perhaps you could use the distraction. But these are various selections that our listeners have sent in. And if you've got something you'd like to hear read, if you know this thing continues and I continue producing these, you can always email them, seth@thethinkingatheist.com. Catherine Stewart is an author and activist and a friend of mine. And she has written a new book called The Power Worshippers that talks about Christian nationalists in the United States government. So I dropped her a line and I asked if I could read part of the book because Joseph had asked if I would read from chapter 10 of The Power. Worshippers, this is yet another gear shift. This is political nonfiction talking about Christian nationalism from the perspective of a journalist and skeptic. So let me read, I'm not going to read the whole chapter, but let me read a portion of the chapter. Chapter 10, Theocracy from the Bench, or How to Establish Religion in the Name of, quote, Religious Liberty. Winter Garden seems a very unlikely place to have a religious war. A charming, family-friendly enclave just west of Orlando, the town has a population of 40,000 and is about 60% white, 25% of Latino origin, and as far as the eye can tell, moderately diverse in its religious and political perspectives. If you want to get certain things done through the city government, on the other hand, the peaceful appearance of religious pluralism dissipates quickly. Tim Grossens and Joseph Richardson, two longtime residents with very different belief systems, know this aspect of life in Winter Garden very well. Tim Grossens, the senior pastor of First Baptist Church of Winter Garden, is a stout grandfather with a ready smile and a ruff of white hair encircling his bald pate. Notwithstanding his avuncular demeanor, Grossens knows how to have a good time with the flashy and powerful. When Senator Marco Rubio, whose outreach director is a personal friend, invited Grossens to President Trump's State of the Union address, Grossens apparently relished the opportunity to rub shoulders with local VIPs, including then-reigning Miss America, Kara Mund. She was real chatty and having the time of her life, Grossens told a local newspaper. He also issued a favorable opinion on the physical attributes of the First Lady. She's as good-looking in person as she is on television. Joseph Richardson belongs to that group of Winter Garden residents who are unlikely to be found in churches like that of Pastor Grossens. A software engineer in his mid-50s, he identifies himself as a free thinker and is an active member of the Central Florida Freethought community. A slim, pensive man, he left behind a childhood in the Assemblies of God Church, a deeply conservative Pentecostal denomination, became an Episcopalian in college, and eventually made his departure from Christianity at 49. His journey was prompted by his concerns about, among other things, the treatment of LGBT Americans. The love the sinner, hate the sin language in the church never translated into action that made sense to me, he says. For several years, Winter Garden has had a policy of opening certain official city meetings with an invocation or prayer. In the 4 years up through early 2019, the city opened 84 public meetings this way. One invocation came from a Jewish rabbi and one came from a Catholic priest. A third meeting commenced with a moment of silence, and in 2015, before the city adopted a restriction that invocators must represent a 501c3 organization, a man who identifies as non-religious was selected by the city commissioner to deliver an invocation that contained no reference to religion. The other 80 invocations were delivered by the representatives of Protestant churches or religious groups, or by individuals or civic leaders delivering sectarian prayers. Pastor Tim Grossens alone accounted for 3 invocations, and other staff or members of his church contributed an additional 5. Members of the First Baptist Squad, like many of the other Protestant groups, seem proud of the explicitly sectarian character of their invocations. It is in Jesus Christ's name that we pray for our leadership. Amen, said Jarian Felton, First Baptist Church's Director of Worship. Joseph Richardson first initiated a request for the opportunity to offer an invocation on May 9, 2014, 4 days after the Supreme Court issued its 5-4 decision in Town of Greece versus Galloway. The conservative majority in that case suggested that efforts to ban sectarian invocations at the start of official town meetings amounted to a violation of religious liberty. The conservative majority, in that case, suggested that efforts to ban sectarian invocations at the start of official town meetings amounted to a violation of religious liberty, whereas such invocations posed no danger of establishing religion. Richardson's experience over the subsequent 4 years could make a mockery of the court's reasoning. Indeed, it would be one of countless instances illustrating how Christian nationalists have gamed the American judicial system to advance an agenda of, quote, religious liberty that in reality serves to establish a very clear set of privileges for one variety of religion. I know they're sitting up there saying that what they've done is fair and equitable, says Richardson. But it's obviously not. The spirit of the Greece versus Galloway decision was equal treatment. But the fact that the Supreme Court put their stamp of approval on sectarian invocation has made it so that legislators think they can insert their religious views into meetings and exclude the viewpoints of others who disagree with them. Sectarian invocations before public meetings, like crosses placed on public lands, may appear to play a merely symbolic role in our governance and are therefore easy to dismiss, but they point to a broader privileging of conservative Christianity in America, including its superior access to sources of public money and the perversion of our most deeply held constitutional principles. They're part of the larger project to use the court system to restore a version of America that never was. Not long after the election of Bill Clinton, Leonard Leo realized that the Christian right had little hope of winning the culture war at the ballot box. A Catholic ultra-conservative, Leo was sure that the public, seduced by the shallow values of a liberalizing culture, would never voluntarily submit to the moral medicine needed to save the nation. The last best chance to rescue civilization, he concluded, was to take over the courts. If activists could funnel just enough true believers onto the bench, especially onto the Supreme Court, they just might be able to reverse the moral tide. He figured out 20 years ago that conservatives had lost the culture war, said Leo's former media relations director, Tom Carter. Abortion, gay rights, contraception, conservatives didn't have a chance if public opinion prevailed, so they needed to stack the courts. Leo founded a student chapter of the Federalist Society while studying law at Cornell. In 1991, he went to work for the organization's national office in Washington, D.C. He set about building the conservative legal movement, forging alliances with prospective jurists and Republican leaders. The Federalist Society, which received some early funding from right-wing donors, including the John M. Olin Foundation, the Scaife Foundation, and the free market think tank Institute for Economic Affairs, became a kind of career center for the conservative young ideologues of the legal world. Undistinguished academic records might be forgiven, provided an unwavering commitment to the cause could be verified. The best of the young talent was meticulously groomed through a program of rotating internships, clerkships, and interim appointments to the welcoming offices of plutocrat-funded think tanks and legal advocacy groups, the carefully manicured terrarium of the conservative legal community, as the journalist Charles P. Pierce has described it. Federalist Society member? Check. Clerkships for conservative Supreme Court justices? Check. Wingnut culture war bona fides? Check. When George W. Bush was elected president, Leo began working as an outside advisor. According to a 2003 email by a White House aide that was sent to, among others, Brett Kavanaugh, Leo was characterized as a point person for all outside coalition activity regarding judicial nominations. He became known as a money man who could be relied upon to drum up funding for promotional activities on behalf of judicial appointees, providing media training for key pundits, or creating grassroots support through advertising campaigns and other means. He also joined the boards of various right-wing and conservative religious organizations, including the Catholic Association Foundation, which funded campaigns to oppose same-sex marriage, and Reclaim New York, whose directors included then Breitbart News chairman Steve Bannon and his billionaire backer, Rebecca Mercer. The Mercer family became major Federalist Society backers too, donating nearly $6 million over a span of several years, according to the Washington Post. But even these munificent gifts were dwarfed by other contributions, often from unknown donors. Leo has advised or helped run over 24 nonprofits, including the Freedom and Opportunity Fund, the BH Fund, and America Engaged. In 2016 and 2017, those three nonprofits, all of which named Leo as president in their tax filings, took in approximately $33 million. Some of the money was spent on the lobbying arm of the National Rifle Association and groups in the Koch orbit, including FreedomWorks and the Center for Individual Freedom. One of Leo's guiding principles was a commitment to end abortion. The conservative legal activist Ed Whalen wrote, "No one has been more dedicated to the enterprise of building a Supreme Court that will overturn Roe v. Wade than the Federalist Society's Leonard Leo." At a 2017 presentation at the Action Institute outlining the Federalist Society's strategy to remake the federal judiciary, Leo said, "I would love to see the courts unrecognizable. Trump," he commented, "is the change we've been waiting for." I'm a huge fan of Catherine Stewart and her work. The chapter goes on. The book obviously goes much more in depth. Be speaking with Catherine on the radio about this very subject shortly, because it's such a necessary conversation. And, you know, that's back to a previous broadcast we had done about the fact that it's not about really any one candidate at this measure. We're looking at an election that affects the Supreme Court and the lower courts and humanistic values in general. And anyway, it's an interesting book called The Power Worshippers, by Catherine Stewart. And thanks again for the suggestion, and thanks for letting me read here on the radio. Let's end with something poetic. As hesitant as I am to read Carl Sagan, because honestly, when I read Carl Sagan, I hear it in his voice. You know, I mean, I hear it in his voice. And I almost feel like I'm betraying his poetic writings, his beautiful, beautiful writings, when I read it in my own. Because there's something about the way he punctuated all of those different phrases and ideas and paragraphs that was so uniquely Sagan. And, you know, I didn't discover Carl Sagan, really discover him, until I was, you know, I was in my late 30s and he was long gone. We had seen the original Cosmos back in 1980, I think, on public television, and my parents loomed over us as he was talking about the cosmos and the Big Bang and those types of things, and they were correcting him. Like, I can't believe they actually let us watch it. But they were correct. No, that's not true. No, that's not in the Bible. No, that's not accurate, you know. But for some reason, they let us continue watching it. And so I sort of grew up with this caricature of Carl Sagan. And then finally, when I left my cocoon of religion, I was finally introduced. I got a handshake to the works, the writings, the speeches, the inquisitiveness and curiosity and passion and amazingness of Carl Sagan. I had produced my own incarnation, visual incarnation of a pale blue dot in video form years and years ago, and I think it remains my favorite Carl Sagan work today. John sent me a message and asked if I would read for you A Pale Blue Dot. And so I'll read it here. Look again at that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that, in glory and triumph, they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of this pixel on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner. How frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill one another, how fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. The Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There is nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate. Visit, yes. Settle, not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known. Thanks for listening. Be safe out there, and I'll see you next time.